What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week on the show, my recent post-screening Q&A with writer-director Edward Burns and the film that changed my life, an interview with director Kimberly Pierce about The Godfather.
That interview was taped as part of a live event series at the Music Box here in Chicago with author Robert K. Elder, whose book, The Film That Changed My Life, highlights 30 directors discussing their epiphanies in the dark, including Edgar Wright on An American Werewolf in London, Richard Linklater on Raging Bull, and John Waters on The Wizard of Oz.
Rob has been a guest here on Film Spotting, and it's definitely a fun read. We'll get to that interview with Kimberly Pierce later in the show. But we start with Ed Burns, an occasional Film Spotting contributor who chose to premiere his latest film, Newlyweds, at the Gene Siskel Film Center here in January. Here's our conversation.
Look, you've been married for 18 years. You know, you got that terrific kid. He's at a great school. I would say, like, I don't know if it ended today, you could probably call it a success, right?
I actually wanted to ask you about the line that starts the movie and we hear at least one more time in the film about 18 years. If you make it 18 years, even if it ended today, you'd have to call it a success. That was actually kind of the jumping off point for you, the inspiration for the film, wasn't it?
Yeah, about 2 years ago I was at a dinner party. It was friends of ours, their 10th wedding anniversary. And somebody made a toast and said, you know, in this day and age, if the marriage ended today, after 10 years, I think you could call it a success. Of course, you know, all the couples were married between like 8 and 15 years. So everybody saw some truth in it. And everybody sort of laughed. But then we also realized it was kind of tragic. So from that, I thought, all right, maybe a movie about sort of modern marriage and what could I explore there? So, as I usually do when I first stumble on an idea like that, anytime I go out, I just start to redirect the conversation towards what I'm thinking I want to write about. And I then met another couple as I was sort of fishing, and they gave me the idea. They were on their second marriage, and he said, you know, I work nights, she works days. You know, I never see her, and this one's going to work. And I thought, that's an interesting couple to explore. So be careful what you tell me afterwards. It may end up in one of the films.
I was actually, the second time I've seen it, and a couple times I was thinking about a bit in Eddie Murphy Raw. I don't know if you remember that stand-up movie, where he's doing a bit about how he's giving away some secrets about how guys really are. And then he starts talking about what the conversations must be like for the men in the audience on the way home. The women saying, you know, those are just jokes, right? He's like, yeah, that Ed sure is funny. So those awkward conversations I'm imagining for you, if these people don't leave and have a few of those, then you failed on some level. I think this movie provokes some of those, that dialogue.
I think so. I mean, you know, I'm constantly, like I said, you know, I mean, a lot of the stuff that I write about, I draw from, not necessarily my life, but I'm always pulling from friends' lives, families' lives, and I go into sort of like some form of investigative reporter mode. And once people have a couple of drinks, like I've had tonight at the Girl and the Goat, and I'm stuffed, and that place is fantastic. You know, people will tell you a lot of their most embarrassing stories. And then with this screenplay, I did something that I hadn't done before, you know. And you know, I've been tweeting quite a bit the last couple of years. And I'm very lucky in that I have these really, like, very passionate, loyal Twitter followers. I mean, they helped me on the last film, Nice Guy Johnny, like, really get out. We had no marketing dollars at all. And they pushed the movie on my behalf. So when I was writing the script, I kind of tweeted out to them what they thought of the idea of Newlyweds and that I wanted it to be a companion piece to Sidewalks of New York. And they seemed to like the idea. So I said, well, share some of the stories. Like, what's the big fight you got into when you were Newlyweds that, you know, that sort of ended the honeymoon period? And 9 out of 10 tweets that I got back had to do with a family member. You know, the brother who came to crash on the couch and wouldn't leave, having to suddenly, like, someone lost a job and you had to move back in with the in-laws or the mother-in-law. Because originally the screenplay was Max and Marcia. It was an examination of three different stages of marriage. So there was Max and Marcia, who had been together 18 years. There was going to be this sort of, this newlywedded couple that I knew that something would happen that might threaten the relationship and the fear of becoming a two-time loser. And then the young folks who sort of got married kind of impetuously. I didn't know at the time that it would be sort of a pregnancy issue. But originally it was three couples six folks, and they would be, I didn't know how they would be linked. And then when I got all those tweets about family being the factor that sort of caused the fights, that I decided to make that the connective tissue.
I think she's a little bit of trouble. Just a, I mean, she more seems like that? Trouble. A little bit of trouble. Just a tiny bit. Just a little bit.
Yeah, I know.
Is she here?
No, no. She actually, she went out.
Does she happen to have friends here or something? She just
I have no idea, but she showed up in New York in the middle of the winter without a coat. I let her grab something from your closet. I hope that's...
Oh.
Cool. That's all right.
Yeah. Do you know which one she took?
Like, don't know. Long, lukewarm. Is that bad?
No. That's okay. I didn't know. Welcome to New York.
One of the key questions, obviously, the movie deals with is honesty, and that first lie about the coat kind of springs more untruths or half-truths, if you will. But that question, and you know, my wife's in the audience, I'll be honest, I'd lie about the coat too, okay? I would. My sisters annoy me, but I'd defend them too and lie about the coat. But this question of does a marriage need total honesty, obviously something you wanted to explore. Did you come in with an opinion one way or another, and did you come out with the same opinion or not?
I think I probably came in and came out with the same opinion, which is kind of like my character says, you know, you don't really need to know everything. You need to know a lot of things, but maybe not everything.
Not everything?
Yeah.
Fair enough. I'm with you on that.
Thank you for putting me on the spot.
Your wife isn't here.
That's true. That's true.
One of the main reasons I think the movie works so well is we believe these performances, and even though you're a new couple, I believe you and Caitlin Fitzgerald in this movie, there's a chemistry that you guys have, and I just wanted you to talk about the process where I know you don't have a ton of rehearsal. How did that work that you were able to develop that sense of, we have to believe that you guys have a spark, and that was what made you guys get together in the first place and the reason why you stay together?
You know, for me and Caitlin, I don't really know. I mean, sometimes you just get lucky. And I think maybe when a film works, the movie gods are smiling on you. And, you know, the funny story about Caitlin, I had written a script a couple of years ago, and she auditioned for that film. We ended up not making the movie. But Aaron Lubin, who's my producing partner, who's from the South Side, what we loved about her audition was kind of like Carrie Bichet when we cast her in Nice Guy Johnny, like, my films are, you know, I try and walk the line between comedy and drama. And to try and, you know, they're obviously, the humor isn't gags, it's more conversational. And the stories are hopefully, you know, my attempt to reflect some version of the world I know. And you know, they it should feel like pretty honest depiction of the human condition with some humor. So finding actors who feel natural. And there's some great actors who are great, but they're theatrical, kind of like Dara Coleman in this film. You know, there are those guys, and they do their thing. But those actors don't really work in my stuff. So I need folks who just feel like a little bit more like everyday folks. So Caitlin and I, the first scene that we shot, and it was really more of a test, because the story with how we made this film, we made it for $9,000 on this Canon 5D, which is still a camera that also shoots video. But the first scene that we shot was Caitlin and I in the loft where we're discussing the fact that Linda has come over to stay, and, you know, she came by the apartment, and the first lie of the cop. And so how we make these films so inexpensively is we ask the actors to do their own hair and makeup and wear their own clothes. And we get these locations for free. And we work with a three-man crew. And we work around everyone's schedules, their sort of paying gigs. So our director of photography, Will Rexer, had been working that day, and he said, hey, I think I'm free. I'll be free after 8 o'clock if you want to shoot. So I called Caitlin. She had never worked with us before, but we had met her. I said, hey, Caitlin, would you at all be up for trying to shoot a scene tonight so we can just get the ball rolling? So she said, sure. And there's no, you know, normally on a film, like the second AD calls you and you get a schedule, and you kind of know what, you know, all right, we're going to start shooting. I'll be occupied for the next 35 days. I call her up and I said, look, we're going to shoot this scene. It's in this apartment downtown. If you can just take a cab, you know, we'll reimburse you, but we'll see you at 8 o'clock. She's like, well, what's my wardrobe? I said, well, just bring some clothes. You know, we're going to shoot two scenes. She shows up at 8 o'clock with her bag of clothes, and it's three guys and a very small camera in a stranger's apartment. And, you know, I mean, if it wasn't, you know, I mean, suspect, definitely. But fortunately, Caitlin was like, all right, I know, you know, obviously I know you in the films. I'm willing to jump in. And it was one of those things where once we started to roll camera, she and I immediately had great chemistry.
Hey, baby.
Yo, babe.
Hey.
Good night.
Really good night. We did 94 covers.
Wow, wow. Fantastic. Get in here and get a glass of red. Yes.
The other thing that I've started to do with the actors is after I do two or three takes working off of the script, then I kind of say, well, all right, that was great. You know, is there anything else to explore here? So, and then we'll do the scene, and at the end of the scene, start to improvise. And then based on whatever we played with that I thought was interesting, we then sort of, I'd say, oh, well, maybe I kind of like that thing you did. Maybe we incorporate that a little earlier into the scene. And because we're shooting in this sort of jump cutty style in the editing room, I knew that I would be able to sort of pull from the improvised versions of the scenes and kind of do almost like a time cut and drop a new improv section into the scripted scene. And sort of that was the process. And again, it wasn't something we went into the production saying, oh, this is how we're going to work. The great thing about making these movies with a three-man crew and no money and no schedule is you now have room to fail. You know, you have room to experiment, and you do fail. And a lot of the things we try don't work, but you know, you just try again, and then it works.
You've gone into some detail about the way you went about shooting this film. $9,000, obviously micro budget, and the three-man crew, and everybody doing their own makeup. Yep. And you've been out really proselytizing for this way of shooting. It obviously really inspires you and works for you. But I'm curious if there was, give me a moment on the shoot where you had one of those days where you said, this is all clicking, this is magical, I should have always made movies like this. But then give me one where you thought, I really wish I had that bigger budget. Yeah. This was not micro, but there had to be one day like that where things were going the way you wanted.
Yeah, there's a scene towards the end of the film where I confront Kerry and Dara on the street. They've just had their night together, and it's, you know, it kind of felt like maybe yesterday in Chicago. It was painfully cold, and we did not have access to any kind of they call holding, like an indoor space anywhere in the city where the actors and the crew could get warm. So we left, you know, we all met at a coffee shop, and we put the mics on the actors, and the street that I wanted to shoot on was probably about 10 blocks away. And I picked the street because it's in a quiet part of Tribeca where I knew we wouldn't be hassled. And we get there, and, you know, I mean, it's probably 10, 15 degrees. The wind is howling, and we've got the scene where, you know, Kerry is the girl who comes to New York without a coat. And she lost the coat, I think. And then, so we get there, and we're like, all right, she's basically in a T-shirt. It's 10 degrees. We have to try and figure out, we can't shoot the scene as written. So we have to scramble and say, all right, maybe Dara gave her his coat. So that's where that thing came in. That just came in on the fly because she was so cold. Will Rex's hands, he said, we have to stop shooting because I'm going to lose my fingers if we continue to do this. And it was one of those where I was like, and also the other thing is, that's one of the few scenes in the film where the Canon 5D doesn't hold up because, I don't know if you noticed, like the sky is really, it's hot or white in the background. And it's one that where it's just like, where a digital camera doesn't work as well as film is when you have high contrast. So with a very white hot sky, it's all blown out behind them. So if you didn't notice, that's good. You were engaged in the scene. But, you know, friends of mine who are camera folks, like, that scene looks terrible. How could you put that in a movie? But anyhow, so that was one. And that scene originally was supposed to be, all of it was supposed to be shot outside. And everyone was too cold. And there was mutiny on the set. The actors were like, we can't work today. So I quickly had a rewrite. And we walked a couple of blocks to a deli that was open. We walked in and said, you know, we need to shoot a scene in our film in your deli because we're too cold. Can we give you $50 to shoot in the corner? And they were like, you don't need to give us $50. Just shoot in the corner. So anyhow, that was a day where it had backfired on us. But, you know, the thing about making films, and, you know, I've been lucky enough to act in big budget films, and the director is always talking about he doesn't have enough time, he doesn't have enough money. And he's always forced to make compromises. As a guy who's been making indie films for 15 years, I can tell you it's every day on every film I've ever made, it's about compromise. when you make a movie for $9,000, again, all about compromise. But if you recognize that that is sort of the nature of the beast, you embrace it. And when your crew is freezing cold and you realize this thing isn't working and we're not getting good performances because everyone's too cold, well, then you don't piss and moan and say, oh, crap, I wish we had more money. You sort of just say, all right, well, let's figure this out very quickly.
When you talk about compromise, I'm curious if tomorrow your next film project studio comes to you and says, we'll give you $9 million or we'll give you $90 million, what things don't change, though? What things from this process, having made Nice Guy Johnny in this film and other films with this style of filmmaking, would you apply, whether regardless of what the budget was?
That's a good question, because I don't really know. It's such a different animal. I wonder what you could apply. I mean, the advantage we have in working like this is that there is nobody looking at the schedule. So, you know, we will go into a day, and, you know, again, we shot 12 days over the course of 4 months. So on any given day, you know, on any film production, you know, you have those four scenes that you're going to shoot. And if you, God forbid, you don't make the day, you're going to go over budget, and obviously, you know, that upsets everybody. And that's how guys lose their jobs. And but we never work that way. Like, we'll put eight scenes on the day, and if we get four done, if we get two done, if we get nine done, it really doesn't matter. It's just a matter of, like, having fun and experimenting. So I think the thing that I would try and do is, during pre-production, during the writing stage, what I did differently on this film, because I had written these parts with certain actors in mind, I brought them into the writing process much earlier than I would have otherwise. Normally, you don't let anybody see the script until you think that script is perfect. Because these were all my friends and people that had worked with me before, I brought them in after the second draft of the script. And, you know, case in point, Max Baker. I mean, it's funny, I never even got around to changing the characters' names. Max plays Max, Marsha plays Marsha, Dara plays Dara. But Max, he's the first guy, because he said he was ready to quit acting. He just said, I don't get good parts. You know, and this is, a Shakespearean-trained actor from the UK. He's been doing, you know, theater on Broadway for 20-plus years. And, you know, but in film and television, he ends up getting, you know, two lines here, two lines there. And he was ready to walk away and just go back to painting. I said, Max, you can't do that. I said, like, I'm writing something now. You're going to help me write your part. And we'll make sure that I put, you know, we'll put it in your sweet spot so that you fall in love with acting. And he said, great, I'm in. So after the second draft, I brought him in. And the beats remained the same. He was going to be a musician. He was going to hit on the young girl. His wife was going to see him. And he was going to ask for a divorce. But all of the dialogue, I said, they're just placeholders. Let's you and I craft it so you can create a character that you can own fully. And I did that with Max. And then after I did that, I said, wow, that worked. Like, there's depth and levels and nuance that I would have never brought to the screenplay had Max not been a part of the writing process. I
swear to God, the woman hates me.
Mike, I don't think she hates you. She's probably not madly in love with you anymore, but I don't think she hates you.
I've got to get out of this marriage.
I already told you I don't want to hear this shit, okay? I don't want to have to go home to Katie and have her asking me about you guys and then I'm forced to lie.
Just tell her the truth. Seriously, I'm done with this. It's because of you, really.
Me? Well, yeah. What did I have to do with this?
When you said 18 years is a success, that's right. I mean, John's in college now. He doesn't need us to be together anymore.
You were talking about writing with specific actors in mind. What about you? Do you write with yourself in mind for some of these roles? Or is it kind of, if you can't find anybody else, you'll default to...
It's sort of both. Like McMullen, I knew I was writing that part for myself. She's the one. I didn't know what part I was going to play. The film The Groomsman, I wrote the part that Matthew Lillard ended up playing for myself because we couldn't get the guy. There were two guys that I wanted for the part I eventually played, so couldn't get them, so I took that. So Purple Violets is another one, the Patrick Wilson part I wrote for myself, but ended up he played. So it kind of goes back and forth. With this part, I kind of knew. And you know what also happens, quite honestly, sometimes, you know, I mean, you've heard me talk. I'm a realist when it comes to my range as an actor. I have a limited ability, but I think I do pretty good.
Not going to see your Hamlet.
Absolutely. What you're saying? Yeah.
Okay.
You know, unless he has a really terrible New York accent. So I kind of, you know, sometimes I'll write something and I think, oh, I'll play that part. And then I realize, oh, that's got some things that I probably, I don't do well. So I better hire someone who's got, who's got you know, better skills than me.
I was curious, though, do you ever see yourself wanting to do something that you don't do well? Do you want to take risks as an actor, maybe a little bit more, or are you very comfortable?
No, quite honestly. you know, where I would like to take risks, because I, you know, I got into this business as a writer, and I only wanted to become a director because I just hated the idea that I would have to surrender control over what I had written. You know, I mean, I went to school thinking I was being a novelist. When I was a kid, I was always a bit of a storyteller. And that's what I fantasize about. You know, I fantasize about stories. You know, I think in 15 years I started to fall in love, let's say, with the camera and cinema and the idea of painting pictures a little bit more. But for me, it always comes down to dialogue and characters. You know, I mean, I was someone who dreamed about writing the great American novel, not, you know, I never dreamed about making the next Citizen Kane. So that's probably why I'm much more comfortable staying in this milieu of these small, talky, character-driven pieces. That said, you know, I've been doing this for 15 years, and now that I've sort of fallen back in love with the micro-budgeted filmmaking, and now that I know that I can do it anytime I want because we're able to make these films so inexpensively, now I'm the idea of stretching, you know, I'm working on this script now that's completely outside of my comfort zone.
Talking about the budget a little bit, actually, you were quoted in an article over the weekend in the Chicago Tribune. I think it was actually yesterday, Friday, and you mentioned when you're ready to go back to a bigger budget film. If that opportunity comes up, when will you feel ready? What maybe is holding you back from feeling like that's something you would want to do at this time?
Quite honestly, just the amount of compromise that's required when the minute someone writes you a check. I mean, the minute a check for $1 million is written or plus, that money goes into the bank and it needs to be spent. And the folks that cut those checks, they are, you know, they expect to and certainly are entitled to participate in the creative process. So all these stories I'm telling you about, like being able to work with your friends and casting these unknowns and all the fun that comes from that type of work, that immediately gets eliminated. Not to say that you can't have fun working with someone else's money. You can. So there is this project that, I don't know if anybody's familiar with the novelist Jonathan Tropper. Tropper? All right, so he wrote this great book called The Book of Joe, and he and I just recently finished adapting that novel, and that needs a significant budget. So I would say probably sometime in the spring we're going to go out and try and attract a couple of big movie stars and go make that film for a couple of big bucks. But in the meantime, I've got my next little $25,000 film that I'm going to make.
Back to you as an actor for a second, I did want to ask you about the challenges of directing yourself in a movie. Do you have someone on set that can say, Ed, that sucked, you need another day?
Yeah. It's Lubin and also the DP, Will Rexer. And we kind of look at the script very early on and sort of, you know, there are those scenes where I know, like, all right, this is going to be a tough scene. So on those days, you guys have to, you know, you've got to watch out and make sure that, you know, that I don't move on before we've got it.
You mentioned the $25,000 movie you're working on right now. Can you give everyone a little bit more detail about that?
Yeah, so it's an interesting story because I acted in this movie over the summer. It's a reboot of the James Patterson novels, Alex Cross. Morgan Freeman played those, I guess, you know, back in the 90s. And they rebooted it more as an action franchise with Tyler Perry, and I play his childhood best friend and partner. So about a week into the shoot, we're having lunch, and Tyler says, he says, oh, I rewatched Brothers McMullen this weekend, and that was critically your most acclaimed movie, right? I said, yeah. And he goes, and then She's the one that came after that, that was commercially your biggest hit, right? And I said, yeah. He said, all right, so you got these two movies, they're about Irish-American families, they're both very successful. And in the 15 years since then, you never made another movie about an Irish-American family? What's wrong with you? He goes, take it from me. You've got to learn to super serve your niche. He said, like, I guarantee you that there is an audience out there for more of those films. So I don't know why you chose not to do it, but I would encourage you to maybe think about exploring that world again. And I sat there and I was like, you know what? He's absolutely right. I walked out of his trailer, walked into mine, opened up my laptop. I wrote Interior of the Fitzgerald's Kitchen Day. I had no idea what the screenplay was about. And I've written two scripts in my life that I wrote in 4 weeks. She's the One and Fitzgerald's Family Christmas. And I think the reason, it's funny, the She's the One story is interesting because Brothers McMullen had been accepted into the Sundance Film Festival. And when McMullen was accepted, no one thought that we would sell the film. We thought, you know, that would be the calling card in order to get an agent and introduce myself to the business. So James Seamus, who is one of the executive producers who now runs Focus Films, Seamus gave me great advice. He goes, look, the 2 weeks that you're in Sundance, you will never be hotter than you are those 2 weeks. Like, everybody's in town. Everybody falls in love with, like, what's happening at Sundance. You need to have a screenplay there. Because they will say, what do you want to do next? And he goes, I don't care what you put in front of them. They will green light it in the room. That's what the feeding frenzy is like. And it was 4 weeks before Sundance. So I sat down. And because I didn't think we were going to sell McMullen, I basically tried to write what I thought was a funnier version of Brothers McMullen. And that, when the film came out, people said, oh, it's a lot like Brothers McMullen. I said, well, yeah, it's the funnier version. That was intentional. You weren't supposed to see the first one, though. And then this Fitzgerald script I wrote in 4 weeks, you know, in the first draft. I mean, I spent 5 hours in the hotel room this afternoon sort of cleaning it up. But I think the reason is, and I think it's because Tyler was absolutely right, it's like, I know the world so much. I didn't have to give any thought to, you know, what might he say? How is she thinking? You know, what does the room look like? What does the kitchen smell like? I mean, it's just, it was so easy to just dip back into my life and see these characters come alive, so.
I'm concerned for you, Mick. I think maybe it's time for you to get focused on something, you know? Maybe get a job.
Dad, I got a job.
That ain't a job. That's an excuse to avoid reality. I think it's time you thought about settling down, sinking your teeth into something, you know? Something that'll give your life some meaning. Now, I'm not saying you gotta go work on Wall Street with this one, but about the fire department, or a cop, you know? You need something with some stability.
You know what, Dad? I don't need any stability because I'm happy right where I am.
Well, I want to go back to the trailer and you write interior, yeah. Because as someone who, you know, once fancied himself, thought I'd do something artistic, and instead I'm talking about movies, obviously that didn't work out. I'm sure there's a lot of people in the crowd who are writers or want to be writers. Go back to that moment where you write interior, but you don't have the story you had here, yeah. The 18 years to really instigate it. So how do you start?
That was interesting. You know, my dad for years has pushed me to do a Christmas film. And I don't know why. He's always said, probably because he thought, you know, the Christmas films make a lot of money. And, you know, he wants some of the money, I guess. I don't know.
You owe him, probably.
I do owe him. I absolutely owe him. So I know that the first scene I wrote, it's still pretty much the same scene that opens up the movie now. It's a scene between the character that I play and his mother. And I have no idea why I started there. But, you know, I mean, it starts at a kitchen table with a, you know, 40-year-old guy and his mother. And, you know, normally when I write, you know, I come up with this idea, and I've talked to you about this before, and I'm still a student of screenwriting, and I believe in traditional storytelling or Hollywood structure, and I love to outline, and I beat my stories out, you know, for months before I allow myself to write. A lot of people say, oh, that's no way to write. Other people think, like, oh, that's the best way to write, because you don't allow yourself to engage in the fun part of writing, which is actually unleashing the characters and letting them speak. You outline and outline until the point where it's like, they're dying to get out. And I love writing that way. But I, for whatever reason, you know, he inspired this idea, and I just sat down and I went. And, you know, I probably had to rewrite the first 30 pages close to 50 times, because there were just, without outlining, there were a number of false starts as you're just trying to figure out. You fall in love with one notion and it takes you down that path, and all right, that's not where it goes. And quite honestly, I'd have to look at the old drafts to realize what draft, where it kind of came together for me.
And if you want evidence of the tight structure in this film, I'm guessing it wasn't an accident that everybody's getting some at one point except you when you're trying to talk Katie into, yeah, a little action. She's not interested. Yeah. Max is having his fling. Dares and Linda are having their fling. Yeah. You're not.
Yeah. Sex at 60. That's the, you know, that's the old, like, old, it's either it's the midpoint kiss or sex at 60. Basically, if a script is 120 pages long, at page 60, you know, the old Hollywood guys used to say you need to have a kiss at the halfway point. So
there you go. Well, Ed, you mentioned Chicago's usually the second wave theatrically. We were the first wave for this movie. Thank you very much for that.
And Adam gets all the credit for that. So.
All the credit. All right.
Thank you very much. Thanks for coming out tonight.
Thank you, everybody. Ed Burns.
Thank you very much.
That was writer-director Edward Burns after a screening in Chicago of his latest film, Newlyweds, which you can rent now via Amazon and iTunes.
Up next, the director of Boys Don't Cry gets an offer she can't refuse. Stay with us. Welcome back to this special interview edition of Film Spotting. With Adam Kempinar, I'm Josh Larson.
Our next interview with writer-director Kimberly Pierce was taped after a screening of The Godfather last November at the Music Box. Pierce is the director of Boys Don't Cry and Stop Loss, and she starts by telling the film that changed my life author Robert K. Elder about how she made the tough decision between The Godfather and a certain Federico Fellini classic.
At first I was torn on it. I said 8.5 because in many ways 8.5 did influence me kind of the most, insofar as I was probably the most shocked when I saw 8.5. So for the same reasons that I said at the introduction, which was excess of passion, of desire, when I watched 8.5 and I saw that they, you know, he was talking about sexuality, you were inside the mind of somebody, it was a train of thought, and the images were so beautiful, and it was 60s Italy, I just was like, wow, I didn't even know that you could put this stuff on screen and then do it so successfully. And it was such an echo of, you know, kind of my own fantasy, my own life, my own familial life. That was probably the first movie that I hooked into, like, the deepest. And just, I don't know, kind of must have seen that about 15 times. So in some ways that preceded my seeing of The Godfather. But then I would say The Godfather was just as profound, but in different ways. Because in The Godfather, he got into violence. And the basic violence that's just simmering under the surface of this movie, it's extraordinary, both emotionally and physically. So in some ways, I would say they both had huge impact, but The Godfather came and did something different.
And there was something really interesting that I had never heard you talk about until we were on stage, and that is Michael being a charming sociopath. And my question to you is, is he a charming sociopath, or does he become one? You know, were the seeds already there, or is he forced to become one?
Well, let's say it's 6 half dozen of the other, right? So in order to become one, one probably had the seeds to be one, right? So can I really go back and think about that opening scene when you first meet him, right? And he's got the uniform on and he's sitting there and he's saying to Kay, this isn't me, this is my family. Now, if he'd been a guy who hadn't been to war, hadn't killed people, right, we might say that he wasn't already primed to do this job. Right, but still something made him capable of doing it. Like, look at the difference between him and Sonny, or him and Fredo. You know, there's something there. And I really think because he's been to war and he's killed people, but he's acting so mild-mannered, it's lurking right below the surface. You know, in terms of seeds, I think about when the opportunity comes up, everybody thinks it's a joke. You know what I mean? Oh, Michael, he can't do that. And why is he so successful? Because he seems so innocent. But look how capable he is. I actually took a class on sound in The Godfather, and one of the scenes they looked at, the sound mixer was actually teaching us, was the scene with the leather chair. You know, and they're just pushing in, and Michael's making the decision, right, that he's capable of doing this, and it's they designed the sound of leather, literally, for that scene, because, you know, sound in movies is all invented.
They want to have a meeting with me, right? It will be me, Klusky, and Saluzzo. Let's set the meeting. Get our informers to find out where it's going to be held.
Now, we insist it's a public place, a bar, a restaurant, some place where there's people so I feel safe. They're going to search me when I first meet them, right? So I can't have a weapon on me then. But if Clemenza can figure a way to have a weapon planted there for me, then I'll kill them both.
So, you know, again, looking at Seeds, would you say at that point he's a charismatic sociopath? He's certainly confident. He doesn't say, he's not like a bumbling fool who says, I don't know if I can do it, and then in the moment he does it. He's very confident, right? That he expertly, you know, kills McCluskey. That definitely takes a lot of nerve. And then look at him at the hospital, you know, when he's defending his father. And he looks down, you know, he comes up with the whole ruse, right? Oh, pretend that you have, you know, a gun in your jacket, you know, use the flowers. And then he looks down and he's not shaking. Well, you tell me. Seems like the seeds were there and that they just blossomed under the right circumstances.
The first two acts, though, you know, protecting his father and then, you know, the first assassination are almost defensive acts. You know, he sort of has to do them to defend himself and defend his family, and, you know, he's got his jaw wired shut in the first one. When, for you, though, does he make that decision?
Which decision?
The decision to lead the family, to embrace his, perhaps, you know, charming sociopathic self.
I would say it's happening in that decision, in that moment with the pushing on the chair. Because I think, at that point, I don't think that he feels like he's just going to kill McCluskey and really disappear. But you could also say it's, you know, it's right after Apollonius is blown up. Because in some ways, maybe he was going to stay in Italy, right? Then that happens to her, and then it's like, that's it, I got to go back. So maybe more there.
And what do you think, besides the fact that I think Michael's a very easy character to identify with, because the motivations are sort of clear. It's, I think he does what most of us would do in that situation, in those very extreme situations. But people like Sonny, why do you think we're drawn to, again, charming sociopaths?
Well, Sonny's a blast. You know what I mean? Like, you guys should look at on the re-release. I'm actually interviewed on that. And what's great about it is they interview a bunch of directors, but they have the outtakes, you know, and they have the casting sessions. And they actually tried bringing Sonny in for the Michael part because they wanted somebody who was a bigger name than Pacino at that point. And it's just so clear. It's like Sonny's like busting out of his clothes. He could never play the young Michael. So I think we love Sonny as long as we have Michael to really identify with and ground us. And we get to look at Sonny, and he's like this great excuse, right? It's like when the audience, part of going to a movie is you get to like play and pretend to be things that you're not, right? So I think that Sonny's excess is just, it's really fun. You know, he's so over the top.
I'm actually just thinking about in film terms in general. What about that type just draws us to film, whether it's, I don't know, Hannibal Lecter is the extreme example, but why do we want to watch that? Why is that entertaining to us?
Again, instinct, I mean, I'll just throw it out there where everybody can disagree, but I think going back all the way, you know, to the Greek tragedies, to Oedipus, you know, Aristotle talks about it. He says that we like to watch tragic characters because they can fail where we can't, meaning, right, they can actually go to hell, you know, they can die, and we get to go along on the road with them to a certain point, and then we get to jump off the train, and the train just gets to go to hell. So I think that, like, with Hannibal Lecter, it's like, maybe you like the idea that if you don't like somebody, you're just going to eat their head, you know what I mean? You know, or you're just going to do something crazy.
Some portion.
Yeah, so you take your wildest fantasies, and you clothe them into, you know, beautiful actors, charismatic actions, and you get to go and have fun. I mean, we've had, you know, drama and theater since the beginning of human history. So I think that's what it is. At least that echoes for me. You know what I mean? But I look at Michael and I'm like, you know, when he lies to Kay in the end, you know, and they say, you know, Don Corleone, I don't have a desire to lie like that in my relationship, but I certainly love that he's able to lie like that to be the consummate gangster that he really is, right? So there's a moment where Michael and I are totally aligned, but then Michael goes down another avenue, and I'm like, wow, you know, I love it. Well, why do I love it? Because something about the identification kind of stopped.
It is fair to say that your fiance is in the audience.
Yes, she is.
You had, when Boys Don't Cry came out, you had some time with Francis Ford Coppola. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
He was great. We were at this like very extravagant party. Most Hollywood parties are pretty extravagant. And he came up to me and he said that he really liked Boys Don't Cry, which that was kind of enough. I could have, like, retired at that point. If I could even watched it, but he liked it. And he said, well, what are you going to do next? And I told him what I was working on. He said, you really should run a studio. You really should have a studio and run it. And I was like, why would I do that? And he was just like, for the control. And that's, it's great. Like, his excess, his sense of control is, it's just manifest, you know?
Earlier we had a really interesting conversation about Michael and the parallels to characters in Boys Don't Cry. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, kind of continuing on what I said before, Michael being this type of innocent with, like, the soft face, the voice that's kind of cracking, you know, he's got some dark past, but it's not that dark yet. And he's essentially an outsider. And his family, they have a family business, and he's supposed to be being kept outside, but he infiltrates in. And as he infiltrates in, he has to deal with all the different personalities in there that are dangerous. You know, ultimately, even that final scene where his sister's husband betrays him, it's very fraught. So I think in a lot of ways, when I sat down to co-write Boys Don't Cry, I was already drawn to the Michael Corleone character, and I think in many ways it influenced me in terms of, you know, Brandon, Tina is an innocent, is a soft face, there's a gentility there, and ends up entering into another family structure, and that family structure is incredibly violent emotionally and physically. And Brandon ends up getting what would you would call almost his comeuppance within the course of the story and also with that family. So certain parallels there.
That's for squares, man. I mean, give me real work, like in the oil fields or something.
I was thinking about becoming a smoke jumper out Mount St. Helens, you know, fighting fires, making lots of money, and then traveling all around. Memphis, Graceland, Tennessee.
Graceland is in Memphis, and Memphis is in Tennessee.
I know.
Maybe you've had enough.
I ain't had any.
No, man. People like you don't need drugs. You just hallucinate 24 hours a day.
In terms of the script, again, this is an amazing script. Mario Puzo, Francis Ford Coppola weighing in heavily. I was just watching it the other day, and I'm like, this film and I think Casablanca, if you had never seen either film, it's almost like you've seen them because it's so much in the culture. You know, leave the gun, take the cannoli, et cetera, et cetera. So I'm wondering if there's anything from The Godfather, since you love it so much, that has become shorthand in your relationships that you sort of quote without even knowing it.
And I want my brother coming out of the toilet with his in his hands. I don't know.
And under what circumstances would you say that?
I can't get into it.
Yeah, okay. again, this is a very American story about basically not just outsiders wanting to become insiders, but for people to reinvent themselves. I don't think any other gangster film really had that element before this. Can you talk about what else is quintessentially American about this film?
Sure. What's quintessentially American, definitely. But in terms of gangster films, I mean, I think the Scarfaces struggle with it, right? Because there's a guy who comes over on the boat in the recent one, in the old one, he's, you know, I think Lower East Side, Italian, they don't have any money. But it's, you definitely see a change in his character, right? He hardens through the course of it. He literally goes from being a small-time criminal to like a massive murdering gangster, you know what I mean, who literally can only be cut down by coming at him with like hundreds of machine guns, right? He's like the monster that just needs to be gunned down. So you see a transformation, you know, there. In terms of what's quintessentially American, I mean, what I always love is just the struggle to be accepted.
So we have time for questions, and we might have a mic out there. Mic person, raise your hand. There you are. So if you have a question, Kimberly would love to take them.
Is there anything about the Godfather that was positive?
We
would have approached the material differently than Coppola did.
And the question is there anything about the Godfather that bothers me? Would I have approached the material differently than Coppola? With this movie, no. There just isn't. I mean, unless I have some epiphany at the end of my life, it's every time I watch it, I am amazed at the absolute simplicity. I mean, there's so many ways you can shoot a scene. There's so many ways that you can put movement into it, right? You can use a crane, you can use a dolly, you can make it handheld. You can do so many things to clutter up the basic drama. You watch this movie over and over and over, and it's the restraint that's amazing, right? I mean, think about the opening scene, all that time on that guy's face, and you're pulling back, and what do you see? You see Brando's, you know, you're learning who he is through how he's moving his fingers in response to what that guy says. Patience, patience, patience. Then you finally get the reverse. And that's not to say that there aren't scenes that are, like, totally hyperactive and, right, they have a kind of neurotic feel. Like, look at when, at the end, when the sister comes in. She's out of her f***ing mind, right? You could have kept a camera still, but you didn't. I mean, I don't know if that was a Steadicam. I don't think they had them back then, but it was certainly very smooth. You're over her shoulder, right, when she meets up with Kay. So it's not that he just uses one formula. It's not that just the camera is slow and static. It's, to my mind, it's completely appropriate to the drama. And it's, you know, I can't find a flaw in the movie. But if you do.
Hi.
Hey.
I have a question. In addition to The Godfather, what have been other films that have left a big mark in your life?
Oh, God, there's so many. I think Goodfellas is a huge influence. I mean, I think it's just the absolute humor of that movie. Like, that those guys are having such a blast. And I think that the opening, you know, if you track it, it's like exactly 10 minutes. And what they achieve in those 10 minutes, that you get inside a little boy's dream. I always wanted to be a gangster. And, you know, you climax with, you know, the trunk coming down, he is a gangster. That's pretty amazing. I mean, so Scorsese's very influential. Rocco and His Brothers is very influential. Wizard of Oz was a huge influence. You showed that last time.
Well, it has so for Wizard of Oz. I'm just curious.
Well, the same thing is just like that you dare to dream, right? That she's looking over the rainbow and that she's imagining the impossible and that she goes. And that's completely the story of Brandon Tina, right? Like, how crazy to be a girl in the Midwest and you're gay, but you want to be a boy. I mean, all, you know, it's just like, it's so not realizable. And then one day you just say, oh, I'm just going to dress like a boy and I'm just going to go and do that. Like, so I think very much my approach to Boys Don't Cry was, and I looked at Wizard of Oz over and over, it was just like, how do we capture the moment of desire and desire acted upon? And how do we take the audience for the ride so that they want to go over the rainbow? So I actually took shot structures, you know, from Wizard of Oz. So there's, you know, but I could go on and on.
I see a lot of Vito in Michael, but I was wondering if there was any place where you saw some of Vito in Sonny.
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, to see some of Vito and Sonny, you have to see what Sonny having maturity, restraint, wanting, I would think wanting respect. Because Vito certainly wants respect, but he goes about it. Where is the questioner? Great. So if you think about, again, the opening scene, which is always very telling in a good movie of a character, Vito's whole thing is, I wish you would show me respect, right? Don't make fun of me now, and I want that respect. So I would say that when Sonny, you know, he thinks it's his time to become the Don, I would say that that's coming out of the same exact desire, which is it's my time. I'm the older brother and, you know, respect me. I mean, the way it manifests is that he's kind of nuts, but actually the fact that he kind of puts it back in the bag and he's, you know, he listens to the Michael thing and then he wants to protect Michael, he does act like a loving older brother, even if he ends up being, you know, a little bit humiliated. So I would say it's probably the desperate need for respect.
What is your take on Michael killing his brother Fred? Has he finished his evolution in the first movie, or is he continuing to change in the second movie?
I think that's another step gone. I mean, I think killing the sister's husband is a step, but it's not yet killing his own blood. And I think killing his own brother, I definitely feel, you even feel like the way that's shot, it's like he's almost sick, right? He's just like, I haven't seen it, like, so recently, but isn't he kind of laying down for most of the scene before it happens? Like, I think he's contemplating it. It's just like, I think you feel the shadow come over Michael. I would say that he goes farther into his, you know, losing his humanity. I mean, and again, the irony or the brilliance of the drama, here's a guy who says it's all about family, right? I'm gonna give up my civilian life and I'm going to enter into this family business in order to protect the family. But he systematically destroys the family as he goes deeper and deeper into it. So by the end, it's like, oh yeah, you're doing it for the family, but you're all alone. And you've lost everything that we recognize. I mean, it was so great just to even look at that final scene and you're like, he's a different guy. You know what I mean? From who we saw in the beginning.
Hail Mary, full of grace,
blessed art thou amongst women. Blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners.
All right, we'll take one more question. Who wants?
Well, I have a question. I know in Hollywood, among female directors, you're kind of the bomb. I mean, you're really, really respected and admired. What was your path? So you went to the University of Chicago, then what happened?
I went to the University of Chicago, and I was fortunate that I studied photography with Scott Rankin, so I got to kind of play around. I had quit University of Chicago and been in Japan for 2 years, where I traveled around and I photographed. And I feel like that was very important. And I took a Richard Stearns writing class. So I was already sort of doing the academic thing, but at the same time kind of exploring, you know, storytelling and creativity, which was great. The University of Chicago let me do that. And then I applied to Columbia, the film school in NYU, got into both, chose to go to Columbia, which was really great because they make you write a ton. And I took 3.5 years of acting classes, which was just great. And I am the worst actor known to mankind. But by doing it, they get you inside the mindset, you know, of the actor, studied with great, great people, worked on Boys Don't Cry, met Christine Michon, and then was very fortunate to be chosen for Sundance. That's, I don't know if you guys know, but what Robert Redford created is extraordinary. It's I was part of a director's lab, two writer's labs, and a producer's labs. And it's just his love of independent films. And they pick you, you know, only pick like 10 people a year, and they just let you learn your craft. And directing is an incredibly difficult craft to learn because it requires, you need a script, you need actors, you need some props, you need some version of realism, you need cameras. So the hardest part about being a director is like actually getting the experience to do it. So I did that. I was very, very lucky. And then, you know, Christine and I found some money to make Boys Don't Cry. It wasn't enough. But she believed in me, you know, which again, it's always getting that first job is nearly impossible. Who's going to trust you with $1 million, right, to tell a story? So she did because she really believes in, you know, directors who have a story to tell. And we went to set with, I was so excited. I was like, oh my God, we're making this. I didn't even care if there was like film in the camera. And at the first weekend, everybody, literally, they were throwing up. And they were like freaking out. I was like, what's the problem? And they were like, you know, you need to do an interview with the IFC, you know. And I was like, I'm shooting my sex scene then. I can't do an interview. And they were like, well, they just gave us $1 million. And I was like, oh, my God, we're rich. But it turns out they had sent me to set with $700,000, and they were going to shut me down if they didn't like the daily. So it's you're just walking the plank every day. But we were really lucky. Christine's brilliant. You know, I had great actors, you know. It just literally by will and just force of character and just commitment, and you know, it's not easy, but you know, I stayed with it, and a lot of people who understood the story and made it better were attracted to it. And of course, you know, Boys Don't Cry became, you know, really this success that none of us could have foreseen, because we didn't know that the culture was ready for any of that. So I don't know if that answers it. That's kind of the school and the professional and the, you know, it's kind of a tightrope that you're sort of walking.
That was director Kimberly Pierce with author Robert K. Elder discussing the film that changed her life, The Godfather. And Josh, I'm guessing there are a lot of filmmakers out there that could probably point to The Godfather.
I would think so, yeah.
Had a big influence on them. Film Spotting will be back in its usual form next week. We'll have a review of the new horror film, The Cabin in the Woods, and share our top 5 up-and-coming actors and actresses.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dassault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Thanks to associate producer Candace Griffiths and PA Tessa Turuskin. Special thanks to Tori Malatia and Shauna Coyne at WBEZ. And, of course, a big thank you to Robert K. Elder. You can learn more about his book, The Film That Changed My Life, at filmchangedmylife.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.